It's easy to find reproductions of great works of art in the virtual world, but there is something powerful about standing in front of a masterpiece in the real world. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll talk with the new director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art and the director of the McNider Museum in Mason City. We'll talk about what can be found in these collections, the experience of visiting an art museum, and the importance of making art accessible. We'll also check in with the Brunier Art Museum at Iowa State University as they recover from the recent flooding in Ames. And we'd like to hear from you. Why are art museums important to you? What's your favorite art collection in the state of Iowa? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are art museums and art collections all across the state of Iowa, and today we'll talk with the directors of two of those museums. Sean O'Hara is with me now. He's the new director of the University of Iowa Museum in Iowa City, and later this hour we'll be joined by Edith Blanchard. She's the director of the Charles H. McNider Museum in Mason City. Also later this hour, we're going to check in with the Brunier Art Museum in Ames as they recover from the recent floods in that part of the state. And we'd like to hear from you as well this hour. Is there a gem of an art museum in your town? What's your favorite art museum? What do you get out of the experience of visiting an art museum? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Sean O'Hara, let's get started with talking about the fact that although you're at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport right now, you're going to be taking over in Iowa City in the middle of November, and you will become a director of an art museum without an art museum because the University of Iowa Museum of Art was flooded in 2008, and actually the collection has been housed at the Figge Art Museum. What are plans for a new museum?
Well, good morning. what are plans? I don't know enough about any plans that are on the drawing boards, perhaps. But I think that one major element is going to be money. Money sometimes gets in the way of reality, I guess, and it's going to depend a lot on FEMA and how the federal government is able to solve the aftermath of the university's flooding and the university as well. So I think that will determine what the next museum will look like.
What does a director of an art museum who doesn't have an art museum do?
I think for one thing, one becomes very creative. The flood was a bad thing. There's no doubt about that. And to lose an art museum is the sort of thing you only see in times of war. I mean, you never see these things in peacetime, especially in the United States. So to lose an art museum is a bad thing. But having said that, without the art museum, it allows the creative juices to flow, and it means that perhaps we can rethink what an art museum is. And I think in the 21st century, when people are now more in tune with the virtual world than they are with the real world, I think perhaps this is an opportunity for the art museum to reinvent itself and to position itself for, you know, the next couple decades.
Well, let's talk about the old-fashioned kind of art museum that the University of Iowa Art Museum used to be. Tell me a little bit about the collection that the university has.
Well, first thing I'd like to say is that it's one of the most wonderful collections in the region and in the country. In my opinion, it's probably in the top dozen or so collections for a university, especially when it comes to 20th century art. And so it's worth making sure that all students and members of the public and staff are able to see these great masterpieces. So The art museum has a lot of art to show, and in fact that's probably pretty rare, because I think a lot of art museums, especially ones that have built new museums, probably don't have great collections. They're hoping that great collections will come. You know, build it and people will donate, I suppose. But in the case of the university museum, there is a great collection. And so, you know, now we have to figure out how do we get people to see this collection, given that we have no physical art museum and we're sort of squatting in certain areas of the university.
Well, what does the collection focus on? What kinds of art would we find if there were a museum to go to right now?
Well, there are some pretty important collections within the collection, and the Elliott Collection is one example of that. The Elliott Collection is a group of works that were put together by Mr. and Mrs. Elliott from Cedar Rapids, and he was a lawyer. And they traveled to Europe, and they put together some masterpieces, some quirky examples of some important artists like Picasso and Miro, and also they collected some very, very important works on paper. So you've got some fairly standard. Artists represented, as I mentioned earlier, and these works are, you know, relatively medium-sized, and you can tell that I'm an art museum person because I talk about size of works as well. And then you have the what I would say is sort of the beginning of the collection, which was the early donations by people like Peggy Guggenheim in the 40s and 50s to the what was then the School of Art and Art History. I mean, it still is, but there was no museum then, and those pieces include Jackson Pollock's first commission, which is unbelievably important.
And that's mural.
Yes, it is mural, and that was done in the mid 40s, it also includes some other smaller works. I guess they can only be smaller, like another Jackson Pollock, Portrait of H.M. You have to realize that at the time, people at Peggy Guggenheim were collecting works that were considered avant-garde, and the School of Art and Art History was run by a professor named Lester Longman, who was somewhat of a visionary, and he wanted examples of the most avant-garde works available, and in fact, they were so... so extreme in many ways that other collections like Yale University, which is the oldest university art collection, turned down the donation. So they built a nice grouping of works early on, and then it built on from there with the Elliott Collection. So it's I would say that the collection is famous for its 20th century works. There's also a very significant African collection. The Stanley Collection is part of that, and there are thousands of works on paper. There are there's an important ceramics collection within that. There is work pre-Columbian work as well. So it's a varied collection. It's relatively encyclopedic in some ways, though it is weighted towards the 20th century on both the European-American side and the African side.
After the floods of 2008, there was a move to have particularly the most famous piece, the Jackson Pollock piece, appraised so that people would know how much this was worth. And this created some controversy, of course,
yes.
Because some people felt that the act of appraising this art indicated that perhaps it might be sold to pay for flood recovery. Why is it important for the university to have these incredibly valuable masterpieces in a collection?
Well, first of all, I would say that the act of appraising doesn't necessarily mean you're going to sell it. We have to do this in art museums in order to ensure works. So that's one thing. It's a routine thing that we do at art museums. Having said that, you know, the value of works, you know, fluctuates. Money comes and goes, but the value of the works in terms of art history is more important. And thankfully, because we're an academic institution, That takes precedence over monetary value. An art museum is a curious institution because it does deal with valuable things, but what it always makes sure is that the monetary value isn't part of the discussion. It's a kind of routine, a logistical thing you have to go through, but it's not part of that discussion, as I mentioned. And works like the mural by Jackson Pollock, the value placed on that also represents the value that the world, people in the art world, place on that work. And it talks about how important it is vis-a-vis other works of art. So that's probably an interesting way of comparing things. For people who don't know a lot about art, perhaps placing a value will help them understand how important these works are. But the value isn't the monetary value isn't what needs to be discussed. What needs to be discussed is the value to human civilization, to academic research, to public education. We're relatively isolated in Iowa, and to have some of the greatest works of art in the world in our museum is extremely important. And that's the value of a museum. A museum is there to show people real things and to get people to understand that by looking at real things, you gain a better understanding of the of human civilization. And especially now when we have most students believing that the virtual world is the real world, it's even more important to have these works in front of people. Mural is 20 feet wide and 9 feet tall. You're only going to ever understand its significance in many ways standing in front of it than you would if you looked on a computer screen.
Well, let's talk about that experience. What is it that you think, for a student in particular, what is it that you think having that physical experience of actually coming face-to-face with the Jackson Pollock or with any of the other great works of art, what do you get out of that?
Well, when you look at a work that big and that important and that significant in terms of the rules it broke and the influence it had beyond that, you get a lot of inspiration. We're a university where people strive to be the best at what they're doing, and they need to understand the way the world works so that they can apply that to their lives. And, it only comes when you see things of value. And yes, I mean, images have value on a computer screen, but seeing a real work of art in front of your face, I think, is what, makes life, worth living.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. Sean O'Hara is the new director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art, and we'd love for you to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org is our email. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about art museums in Iowa. We're talking about specifically right now the University of Iowa Art Museum, but we'd love to know if you have a gem of a museum in your town or what it means to you to have access to some of the greatest works of art in the world in Iowa, in Iowa City, in Des Moines, in Mason City, and around the state. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest right now is Sean O'Hara. He's the new director of the University of Iowa Museum in Iowa City. And you're also right now, you're at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. You're originally from Hawaii. What brought you to Iowa?
Well, my family's originally from the Midwest. I think that's why my dad says he raised me in Hawaii. But so I'm comfortable with the culture here, and I have family not too far away. So that originally brought me here, and I think that the Midwest has a lot of potential. It has a great history. It drove the development of the United States for a good part of its life, and I'd like to live here and see what we can make of it. Yeah.
With the collection that you're working with right now, what are you trying to do, or what have you tried to do at the Figge to be a part of the Davenport community and also to be to make art accessible to people in Iowa?
Well, art museums are at a crossroads, and they're basically 19th century institutions that are trying to be as relevant as they can to people's lives. And I think that I would imagine – my view is that in the last 10 years, the world has changed more than perhaps in the last 50 years. So one of the things that we're trying to work on at the Figge Art Museum is to see if we can serve the public's needs better than we had been, and seeing if there's a new role for art museums in people's lives. And so it takes a lot of work. You have to work with a lot of partners. You have to understand that you're not the only institution trying to educate people or serve people in a certain way. And so what we're doing is we are, we are making sure that the art museum not only fulfills the traditional role that art museum fulfills, which is, bringing objects to people, but also seeing how the art museum can help improve, facilitate education in the region. And actually, it's paying off in a number of areas. We do a lot of work with schools and colleges and universities. What's particularly nice about having an art museum is you have wonderful objects. And for a lot of school programs that have cut out visual arts for various reasons, they've been able to use our teachers and our objects to teach other subjects that are probably perhaps more taught through books, like social studies and history, even geometry. And the thing that perhaps we lose sight of is that most people are visual learners, and so using art, interesting, inspirational art is a way of not only increasing their understanding but also creating more interest in some of these subjects, which could be, quite dull in some ways.
Now, I know I'm making you do it today, but do you feel like you, because the world has changed so much, do you feel like you spend a lot of your time trying to justify the existence of art museums and the investment in art museums?
Sort of. I sometimes have to explain what art museums are, because I think a younger generation doesn't quite know what they are. I don't think they spend a lot of time in art museums, I kind of defend the real world versus the virtual world. I love computers, and I've spent a lot of my career with computers, but I also understand that they're a means to an end, not an end in itself, and that at the end of the day, it's a real world that we have to contend with, and an art museum is all about that, and I'm very happy to be the defender of real things.
Debbie is on the line in Garber. Hello, Debbie.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I would just like to talk about my own personal experience with art. Several years ago, I went to Europe and experienced some of the museums, the fountains, and so forth in Italy and in different countries, and it was a life-altering experience for me. And they are culturally rich, because of the age of some of the works and so forth. So they get to experience them every day. And I just would like to applaud our country having museums, because we need that experience standing in front of it. Jackson Pollock's a perfect example, because you see a picture of it on the internet and, it's kind of a lot of colors and squiggles. But yet you stand in front of one of his pieces and you can feel what this artist felt like as he painted it. And I'm just saddened that we have to search out museums. Sometimes families can't afford it, but I noticed that most museums offer nights that families can go for free and experience just the wonder of art. And I just applaud any museum that tries to keep going in these difficult economic conditions when people don't always appreciate what they're doing for us.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And it's interesting that you talk about the sort of physical experience, the visceral experience of standing in front of a masterpiece. And, you know, it's such an ephemeral thing to talk about. But I think that's a large part of what you were talking about, Sean, that people need to have that feeling.
They do. And actually, you're touching upon an interesting point. You know, people in Europe are raised with this stuff. And they were raised with the real world, and they are, you know, forced to look at fountains and art, just getting from A to B. You know, people in these cities walk more; they use public transportation, so they're not sitting in their cars cocooned. Of course, it isn't, you know, -40 degrees as well, so it probably helps in those countries. But people are forced to look at things, and I think that it is that sort of daily exposure to art that actually gets people to understand that the real world is incredibly important. And I think that sort of explains why there's this greater appreciation perhaps there. And I think that it is our duty, and you mentioned this, our duty as Americans to make sure that our citizens are exposed to as many experiences as possible, you know, especially when they're growing up. I mean, I can address this because we're at a university. It's people are finally realizing that, you know, the brains don't really, you know, fully mature until their late 20s. It's incredibly important that we make sure that all our young people are exposed to this so that when they're older, they appreciate it as well. And, you know, I mean, I think that you can appreciate it.
Debbie, thank you so much for your call. And Rochelle is on the line in Davenport. Hello, Rochelle.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I'm calling actually from Davenport. I'm glad that we have the Figgy here, but I wanted to say too, along with the other caller that was on too, that we were in Chicago about 10 years ago when the Renoir exhibit was there. And before I went to the museum, I had a misconception of museums of having old stuff. But when we were there at the Renoir exhibit, there was a very large painting of a lady, I think, with a chair. I don't remember the name of the painting, but it seemed like it was alive and moving and breathing at you. And it was incredible to watch it, and it was fantastic to see it and have a better appreciation of the art and everything else that is there now, too. And I agree, too, with the guest that people in Europe have a better appreciation, or even around the world, have a better appreciation for artwork, for botanic gardens and fountains, and having a real-life thing to relate to rather than a computer or a textbook. And you can only learn so much from a textbook. And then once you actually go to see something and it moves you so much, then you have a better appreciation for it. So I'm glad that the Figgy is here, and I'm hoping that all the other museums are doing well in their flood recovery, too. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Rochelle, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
That's an interesting, you were talking about how in Europe people tend to just come into contact with those works of art. And here we do need to go out of our way if we want to have that physical experience with art.
Yes, and I think that's the job of museums and other cultural organizations, that they have to make sure that people are exposed to all manner of you know, wonderful cultural assets that we have.
We'll talk more about art museums after our break. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest today is Sean O'Hara. He's the new director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about art museums in Iowa, art museums across the state of Iowa. We've been talking particularly about the University of Iowa Art Museum, which is in Iowa City, although it's a museum without a museum at the moment, unfortunately, because of the floods of 2008. We're going to be talking with the director of the McNider Museum in Mason City in a few minutes. And right now, quickly, I'd like to check in with the Brunier Art Museum in Ames, Iowa. And this is Allison Jewell on the line from the University Museums. Hello, Allison.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
So the Brunier Art Gallery in Ames has had to delay some exhibitions and some openings because of the flooding. How great was the flood damage there?
Well, for most of Wednesday, August 11th, Ames was kind of separated into two different islands. And after we assessed all of the damage, Iowa State went into recovery mode. We realized that the Schumann Building actually had 5 feet of water in it, and some of the lower below-grade rooms were completely flooded. Temporary environmental controls were set up in the museum spaces. All the temporary power was run pretty quickly to critical parts of the building. And then the lovely job of recovering salvageable materials from the ground floor took place in those few days that were after. The water actually didn't recede until Friday that week, and they still had to pump out the lower levels of the building.
What kinds of things did you have in the lower level?
We did not have any collections, which is a
very
blessing.
Fortunate, yes.
And we actually had mainly exhibit furniture, pedestals, display cases, plexiglass vitrines, and some packing material, that kind of thing.
What have you had to do to recover?
The main concern was that the collections remained unharmed, and the biggest threat to that was the environmental controls. Because the building lost power, because it was, if you remember, so hot and humid that week, and then, of course, with the flood waters, we were trying to stabilize the collection, and with the help of ServiceMaster, who's a contracted agent for Iowa State, we were able to run actually great air conditioning and humidity control systems into our space very quickly.
So it's a whole lot of hassle, but the main collections are unharmed?
Unharmed.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. Well, you have had to delay some things this fall. When you get things going again, what can people see at the Brunier Art Museum?
We actually have a great fall planned. Unfortunately, like you said, it is delayed a little bit, but we're part of university museums, and so there are multiple entities that are open and working, and you can come and visit right now. We may remain committed to our educational goals, and this year we get a chance to showcase some incredible examples of art focusing on the human form, which is part of our collecting mission and our exhibition mission. The depictions of the human form will range from everything from realistic drawings of Frank Lobdell and Beth Van Hosen to the abstracted forms of sculptor William King, who has a great sense of humor about his sculptures. The Frank Lobdell show is actually open right now, and it's at the Christian Peterson Art Museum in Morrill Hall on campus, so people can stop and see that. The Beth Van Hosen show, as well as her husband, Mark Adams, will both be displayed in the Brunier once we get the okay to open the building and have it occupied by the public.
And what do you think the timeline is for that?
You know, we haven't heard. There's a rumor mill, of course, of about the middle of the month, but it all depends on some electrical work and some other contracting services.
All right. Well, Allison, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, and good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Allison Jewell of University Museums at Iowa State University. She's talking about the Brunier Art Museum, which was flooded, but mainly just the basement flooded, fortunately. We're talking today about art museums on Talk of Iowa. Sean O'Harrow is with us still. He's the director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art in Iowa City, or at least he will be in mid-November. And joining us now is Edith Blanchard. She's the director of the Charles H. McNider Museum in Mason City. Hello, Edith.
Hello.
How are you?
Great.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Tell me a little bit about the McNider Museum.
Well, the McNider Museum was founded in 1965 through a gift to the city by the McNider family. So we're kind of unique as museums go because we're not independent, yet we don't belong to a university. We're actually part of a municipal entity. And over the years, we have grown substantially. So we started in a large formal house and have grown and added on to that house to being over 20,000 square feet at this point.
What kinds of collections do you have under that roof?
We focus on American art. That is what our primary focus is. Early on, they did collect art of all different countries. However, they felt that, you know, really to focus in their collection, and have the best collection possible. They needed to make that decision, and that happened. And then in the 80s, we also acquired a puppet collection by famed puppeteer Bill Baird, who was originally from Mason City. And so that's one of our other most popular exhibitions is Bill Baird's puppets.
All right. And people would be familiar with Bill Baird because he did the puppets for Sound of Music.
That's right. The Lonely Goat Herd is probably one of our most famous stops, you know, in front of the Lonely Goat Herd display case. And so we've always thought, you know, we need to, like, conserve them or whatever. And, you know, it's we have to always work around the public's desire to see the puppets from The Sound of Music.
So you can't actually take them behind closed doors.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to work with it. They've actually even traveled when they had the anniversary of The Sound of Music. And our curator went and was with them the whole time, you know, and curated them in New York City and then brought them back. So they have traveled and you know, they do leave our display care, and sometimes they're not all on display, obviously, for conservation reasons, but, you know, they are hands down one of the most popular, I would say, for all ages.
You mentioned that the museum focuses on American art. Can you tell me about a couple of individual pieces that you're particularly proud of?
Well, probably the one that I think that the public most identifies with us is Spring Tryout by Thomas Hart Benton. And this was purchased many, many years ago. It's actually an oil by Thomas Hart Benton. And, you know, it was done in a time period where, you know, he was exploring, you know, a rural memory that he had had as a child. And Mason City, obviously, we live in a hub of, you know, small towns, a lot of agrarian neighbors here. And we actually serve not only Mason City, but the surrounding nine counties because, you know, we're the only thing really like our kind up here of this size. And so I would say that is probably one of our most popular pieces is Spring Tryout. And it's a very traditional piece, so we feel it's very accessible for the public. It's something that they can identify in living in a rural community, especially in a rural state like Iowa. And then we have several other pieces that, you know, are just fantastic. We have Alexander Calder, which people are always fascinated to find that art isn't just, you know, ceramic or it's not, you know, a print that hangs on the wall, but his sculptures were actually movable and, you know, sort of challenged the viewer to think of art in a new and exciting way.
Why do you think it's important to have an art museum like this one in Mason City?
Well, the art museum has always been extremely well supported because there is such a desire in our community to have that experience. And I think that that is why we exist and why we're important is that, you know, we have become such a part of the community and such a part of people's lives that, you know, people have grown up here. It's kind of ironic. I used to take classes at the McNider when I was a child, and I remember it just being always, you know, one of the probably most important places that we have here in North Iowa to allow people to experience something new. You know, while we do have a collection that's primarily American art, we have it as one of our policies to bring international exhibitions in at least every other year to expose people to other cultures. And one important element that we have here that some museums don't have is that we have working studios. We have ceramic studio. We teach stained glass classes. We have classes for kids of all ages. You know, and for us, that was a really important step to do to really ingrain in the community the importance in art and not just visually seeing it, but also doing it.
Why do you think it's important for, and I know a lot of museums hold classes for children to get them, to get their hands dirty and their paintbrushes dirty. Why do you think it's important for people to have that experience of making art?
I think a lot of people don't realize their creative side until they have an opportunity to experience it. You know, sometimes we have people who have never taken an art class ever in their life, and they go ahead and take that class maybe after they've retired, and they realize, oh, I wish I would have done this sooner. You know, we hold classes on weekends and evenings, and we really try to fit it into people's schedules so that even if you are a working parent or you know, you work full time, or even if you travel a lot, you're able to do classes. We have one shot classes where you only have to come one time, so it's not a repeated class. We have other classes that, you know, are for people who really want to learn more about something such as stained glass. It'll meet twice a week for several weeks. You know, and for our kids, we like to think that we're a great supplement to the school art system, where, you know, you do get that experience of doing art in the community schools. But for some kids, you know, they just want to do more. They want to learn more. They want to learn something a little bit more in depth, you know. And we have kids as young as 6 years old doing pottery classes, which really allows them to, you know, basically get their hands dirty. I mean, you know, and really experience it and feel it. The emotion of working with an artistic medium.
Sean, why don't you weigh in on that? Why do you think it's important for people to have the experience of creating something?
Well, I mean, in essence, we're three-dimensional, creative, interactive creatures, and I think that we don't fully understand things unless we participate in them. And, you know, it's one thing looking at a work of art and not being able to touch it, but it's another thing being able to create something. And you know, what we've learned in school programs is if you get students to create and to make what they are thinking and to make their thoughts into physical reality of in some sort of way, that they understand things better. And I think that's just the nature of human beings. And, you know, I think that you know, if we were forced just to watch things all day like TV and so on, I think we'd probably turn to mush and, you know, cease to be what we are. So I think that, you know, it's part of our essence that that we want to make things and create things and touch things and smell things and taste things. And
well, and my lack of artistic ability has certainly helped me appreciate the masters and what they can do.
You know, and here's one thing I have to say. I mean, everyone says they're not creative and everyone says that they can't make art. And in fact, you know, there are some very famous artists who probably couldn't draw to save their lives, but they express their emotions through paint, and I think everyone can. So I think that's just a mental block that you were raised with.
Well, whether that's true or not, we'll work that out on another show. Holly is on the line right now from Fairfield. Hello, Holly.
Hi, Charity. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a great discussion, and Mr. O'Hara, I wish you the best of luck finding another home for the museum.
That
should happen soon. I just wanted to, I have lived in art my whole life. I have a BFA in art, and many years in school would study all the masters. And I just wanted to speak to that experience of seeing an artwork live, real, and in person. It just, I can remember going into the university, or Art Institute of Chicago Museum for the first time. It just takes my breath away to see these paintings that I'd studied for years, and it's a completely different experience in terms of it feels like there's some part of the artist, the deepest part of that artist, reaching out to me and engaging me on a level that doesn't really happen when you're looking at a book or looking at something on the computer. And I'm just thrilled that Iowa has so many fine small museums, and I'm taking down names because there were some I didn't even know of to plan my grand tour at some point to look and see what kind of treasures all of the, you know, that have been so painstakingly collected in Iowa for the general public. But thank you so much for this conversation. I think it's really great.
Well, Holly, thank you for calling. And do you have any art museums in Iowa that you have visited that we may not know about?
I doubt that, although I've been up to the University of Iowa Museum pre-flood, and I have to say that Jackson Pollock, just it felt like someone had, you know, it took my breath away in the most literal sense of the phrase. And I'm really excited to, we like contemporary art down here, so I've been to a lot of more of the galleries in Iowa than I have actually museums. But when you learn about what kind of treasures are in these places, it just bears jumping in the car on a weekend and checking things out.
Thank you for that. By the way, I'm really happy to hear that we have so many art lovers in our community. But one interesting point I'd like to make, because you mentioned that you have a BFA and that you have an art background, is that for those people who you know, perhaps don't have an art background, they have to realize that those artsy people, you know, were once not artsy people. I mean, you know, we before you did your BFA, I don't know how much art you had, but you know, there are a lot of people who start with nothing, and then they come to museums and they explore things, and so you know, for everyone, it's a first day, and so you know, I'm optimistic that everyone in Iowa will you know, appreciate art in one way or another.
And we try to at the McNider, you know, an example is we try to offer a lot of opportunities for people to come to our museum and what we call, we joke that it's like non-threatening ways to come and learn about art. And we have a morning coffee that's in the morning for people with flexible schedules. We have what's called McNider Off the Clock, which is essentially a cocktail hour that we use for when we do exhibit openings, and we do it on a quarterly basis. So people might be coming to socialize with friends and to get that human interaction, but they're also becoming accustomed to visiting the museum on a regular basis is what we hope, you know, in the long run. And so, you know, that addresses your issue of, you know, oh, I feel like I have I can't connect with the museum, I'm not going to go there. You know, we're trying to address it in different ways of getting people in kind of in creative avenues.
Hi.
Jim is on the line now from Spencer. Hello, Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was listening to a lot of the earlier comments about well-established cultural icons in Europe and, you know, how impressive that is to grow up around those types of things. And I think that America, the United States exactly, being, you know, such a young country, you know, there are a lot of people here that probably feel like art is something that belongs in Europe or, you know, in this day and age we really can't afford. But I think that, you know, a lot of people that might be listening to this program and are wondering what culture really means to them in their lives, you know, maybe they don't even realize that until they get to the point where they think they need to finally write their, their life story. You know, of course, the written word being a work of art, these are all things that, you know, we shouldn't just save for our funeral. I think a lot of people need to understand that in this world that they leave a mark and, you know, they can support that kind of activity, they can just appreciate it, or maybe they're born to be one of those creative individuals that, you know, does do something really fantastic, like a building or, you know, public art or a symphony. But those are the things that really identify a culture, a country, as being significant in the world. And, you know, we only have to stand up and look around and see what wonderful things are happening around us to appreciate that. You know, even if we don't understand all of the little, you know, details of a creative person's lifestyle, those are things that they do for us. And, you know, we can enjoy them at practically no cost, especially here in Iowa where it's like, I don't know, less than 50 cents per person that we contribute to the arts. So.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. And Jim brings up an important point, too, that we think about, many of us think about engaging in the arts or going to museums. It's something that it's strictly a leisure time activity. Do you think that people, Sean, can you answer this first? Do you think that people need to make it more of a priority to engage with these things in their lives?
Yeah, I think that it has to be a very regular thing. I go back to our discussion on education. You know, we need to. I know this is going to sound terrible to say, but you know, art shouldn't be special. Our art should be normal, and it should and it is normal. I mean, you know, architecture is a very important form of art, and we see it every day. And I don't think people have, you know, elitist views towards architecture so much because they have to, you know, interact with it. And that's what we should do with art. And I think that, you know, art should be in people's way. It should be everywhere. It shouldn't be removed and seen as something superfluous or extra or a leisure activity. Because, you know, unless you can't see, and I'm talking about the visual arts here, then you know you're going to look at things and I think you know it's just part of our education as human beings and our enjoyment and you know you you your life needs to be, you know, lived to the maximum, and you have to enjoy it.
Right, and maybe we would appreciate art more if we could take it for granted. We were talking earlier about the European cities, where when you move around one of those very old cities, you are experiencing art on a daily basis, and maybe you're not thinking about it.
You know, it's interesting. We get a lot of Europeans, especially lately, into the Figge Art Museum, and it's interesting because it's almost like when you're a German tourist, you will always go to the art museum because they're used to it. They have great art museums, and it's normal for them. And it would be nice if, you know, eventually we got to that state, so to speak, with our own society.
Well, Sean O'Hara, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Sean O'Hara is the next director of the University of Iowa Art Museum in Iowa City. He takes office, so to speak, on November 15th. And Edith Blanchard, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Edith Blanchard is the director of the Charles H. McNider Museum in Mason City. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. We had production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. You can listen to the show anytime. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And you can send us email anytime. If there's something you'd like to hear on the program, if you know somebody with a great story to tell, send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Charity Nebbe, and tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we'll talk about the act of making music together. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.